You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
I'm going to make him a movie he can't review.
It's B-Movies, thanks to Metze Bar, your source for all things NZIFF, thanks to the best place to go before or after.
It certainly is B-Movies. It's B-Movies number two. We had the first instalment last week, and this morning we've got director Justin Pemberton in the studio. Kia ora, Justin. How are you? We have got you up here this morning to chat about your film, Capital in the 21st Century, which is in this year's Film Fest. It's really interesting. It's like, we were just saying, 400 years of sort of economic and social and cultural theory condensed into an hour and 45 minutes. It's dense, but it's really interesting as well. And it's based on Thomas Piketty's book, which is also called Capital in the 21st Century. What made you want to make a documentary about this?
Well, the book came out in 2013 and surprised the world because it went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And as you said, it's like 700-page paperback on economic theory. So it surprised
That's
everyone. And that caught
so
my...
crazy that got number one.
Yeah.
Can't imagine reading a 700-page
Well, it was I think it was around the time of the Occupy movement, so there was... people were starting to talk about inequality. But what was so extraordinary about his book, or is so extraordinary, is that he traces capitalism back to before the Industrial Revolution and tracks inequality and over those periods and projects into the future. And sort of concluded that that period after World War II, where suddenly the middle class rose up and there was low inequality, was more an aberration than the natural setting of deregulated capitalism. And instead we are in danger of circling back to that 18th century style, unless we change course, which is the point of the film.
Well, I found that really interesting watching this, because I guess when you are surveying 400 years worth of history here, there is so much to unpack. But those threads come through really strongly in the documentary about how we're kind of in cycles that are longer than we sort of maybe had previously thought about. What was it like? Because there's a lot of really interesting people that are talking heads in this documentary, including Thomas Piketty himself. How did you get in touch with him? Did you just contact him and say, look, we really want to make something about this? Or did he, was he already sort of thinking about trying to make it into a documentary?
Well, New Zealand producer Matthew Metcalf, who is a quite well-known New Zealand film producer, read the book about the same time I did, and he got in touch with Thomas directly and Thomas's publisher and said, I think this would be a great movie. When I heard that he was talking to Thomas, I got in touch with him. So I kind of came in that way.
I'm also here, hello.
And he just said, you know, start developing it. So I started writing and was constantly sort of in, from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep, all weekend, everything, I was just frantically trying to get something together to give to him. And Thomas liked it.
That's awesome.
And he did. I mean, there were apparently about three or four producers that were at that point trying to
get something
vie for this opportunity. So, but I think, you know, just that earlier point you're saying, though, the biggest thing that got me was the our time horizons in our own lives are so short that it's easy to think things have always been this way. Nothing can ever change. You know, this is just the way the world is. And that's understandable. But, you know, when you kind of zoom out and you can look at hundreds of years, you'd see different patterns. And I think that was that's the big thing that I wanted to get across, was that things can change.
Totally.
They have, and actually they almost certainly will again.
Oh, absolutely. And another thing I found really interesting is that he's a big advocate for taxing multinational corporations and having sort of, I mean, graduated tax, I guess, which is something that comes up often at the moment in political discourse. But the way he talks about it, he breaks it down in such a way that makes it so simple. You're like, why aren't we doing this already? And then the idea goes back to, well, the power tends to lie with the people who have all of this money, these massive corporations like Apple, who sort of float around. There's a really good shot in there of kind of like zoomed out image of the world with a big sort of the big kind of cloud in the sky. And then you're talking about Apple. And I'm like, that is kind of what those technology things, they do feel like the perfect storm. They also feel like they're watching you everywhere as well, which is a bit freaky too. When you're sort of trying to make these really big economic and like cultural theories sort of accessible for a film, how do you break that down without necessarily losing the detail and the depth of those theories?
You know, it is tricky because you don't, there's not one audience that just has one set of background knowledge. I mean, you've got to think, who's watching it and how much do they know? And when are they either lost because they don't know enough and you've not told them enough? Or are you spending too long here and do people go, yeah, I got it, move on? That is the big discussion we had over and over and over again. But I think for me, one of the things I looked at, I mean, the film offered an opportunity to sort of play out the greatest hits of history or the worst hits of history, if you're thinking, you know, when you're talking about slavery and World War II.
In its true sense, not necessarily its awesome sense.
The top hits. And that was kind of, I wanted to do something chronological. The book doesn't really work in that chronological way, but for me to be able to see a flow of Capital and to see patterns, I think that you needed to know where you were and what had just happened before and what happened next. So that's one of the big differences with the film. And I talked to Thomas straight away as well about the fact the film will be different to the book. It's not the book, they're companions. And, you know, if you see the film and you really like it and you want to go deeper, then believe me, the book has everything you want. He's also put all his data online and he invites, you know, people to, you know, so he's been very transparent about where it all comes from and how he's sort of got these conclusions. But, you know, I think, in the end, it's just kind of, you have to go with your gut in terms of, have we explained it enough? Or listened to it enough? But, you know, we only had 100 minutes as well.
Yeah, exactly. So. Do you sort of sample it with people and have people watch it and say, hey, I'm actually a bit lost here?
And one of the things I also, you know, for me, it was always important that the film was talking to people potentially who wouldn't read the book and also younger people, because it is a film that's ultimately talking about the future and where we're going. So I talked a lot, you know, to people, who some of the younger people that were working on the film and researchers, other colleagues that, you know, and sometimes were surprised by what people didn't always put together, you know. I mean, World War I and World War II are completely different wars fought for different reasons, but sometimes they feel like the same.
People get
confused.
I think also the time period being so close to each other as well, and especially in the context of this film and this book as well, where you're covering such a long period of time, seeing the difference between those two wars, like back to back in such a short space of time. For me, I kind of had a reminder. I was looking at that and I was going, wow, this is amazing that in such a short period of time, the reasons for conflicts can be so vastly different. That was something I found really interesting in that. And that's something I enjoyed throughout the whole documentary, was that these long ideas and these like short conflicts and stuff, they all sort of sit next to each other quite tightly. And it gives you a good kind of overview of things that you don't always necessarily think in conjunction with each other. I found it really interesting as well, some of the theorists that you interview or that are speaking in this, we're talking about a lot about how capitalism has changed in ways that we aren't necessarily always thinking about, like talking about how capitalism isn't necessarily labor anymore. It's not people making things for, you know, bosses and stuff like that. It is this big kind of multinational corporation ownership of things. And it's a fascinating thing to think about how the world is changing in ways that we haven't even quite registered. And we're in the middle of it, you know.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes capital seems to us to just be the housing market or something like that, you know. And we're not looking at the big picture. You know, capital is in many ways the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz.
He's the Wizard
of
Oz, yeah.
That is, you know, this huge dominant force, but is actually quite a represented by quite a small entity.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're talking about things like those multinational corporations, you know, that they don't employ anywhere near as many people as the big corporations of the past.
No.
You know, they do operate, you know, up in the clouds and can move their money and pay no tax. And they are destroying the kind of social contract that has existed for many years, which is, you know, that education, healthcare, roading, the justice system, which they love, you know, are all paid for by taxes, and yet they're not keeping their side of the agreement.
Yeah, totally. In terms of the kind of content of the movie as well, for listeners at home, it's a really interesting mix of clips from old movies, TV shows. You've got, as you were saying, you've got some clips from like very famous trials and courts and things like that as well. So it's a really big kind of broad overview of the subject from a lot of different angles, and it's totally engaging as well. I feel like you could definitely take your teenagers along to this and go watch it with them. It's a good way to kind of into some ideas and things like that too.
I wanted it to be a bit of a pop culture mashup.
Yeah,
you know, it
is
a mashup of history.
Yeah,
and because partly because that's what I like.
Yeah,
but also because, you know, the stories of capital have been told for hundreds of years in our stories, you know, going right back to the earliest songs, you know, they were songs were stories that were passed from town to town and were, you know, that we used to, so we've sung about it, we've, Jane Austen was writing about it and her, you know, and her novels, which were sort of renowned for realism at the time, you know, which we kind of forget. And yeah, obviously now it's in everything. It's in The Simpsons. It's in rap songs. It's in, it's just everywhere.
I particularly enjoyed The Simpsons cameo in the middle of it there as someone who grew up on The Simpsons and Family Guy. Yeah. So if people want to go and head along and see Capital in the 21st Century, it's got four screenings so far in the film festival. It's playing at the Embassy Theatre on July the 28th. It's playing also at the Embassy Theatre on the 29th. It's at the Penthouse. Oh, hang on. I think I'm reading.
Thank you.
That's Wellington.
I'm reading Wellington's one. That's why I was like, hold on a second.
July 21st at the Civic Theatre, July 23rd also at the Civic Theatre, and July 24th at Event Cinemas. The two first ones are in the afternoon and the third one is in the evening. But you can get all the information on the NZIFF website.
And there's student discount too.
There is, which is great. So if you want to go head along, it is a really good thing. If you're studying politics, if you're studying economics, anything like that, it's a really good movie to go and watch, I reckon. Thank you so much, Justin Pemberton, for your time this morning. But meanwhile, we're talking movies still for the New Zealand International Film Festival, and we've got old mate Amanda Jane Robinson in the studio. Kia ora, Amanda, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It's nice to have you back up in the BFM studios.
Nice to be here.
You're talking about a director who is very close to your own heart, also very close to my heart. I'm a big fan of old mate Agnes. We're talking about Agnes Varda this morning. There's a huge feature on her in the NZIFF this year. It's called Viva La Varda. It's got five of her movies and then Varda by Agnes, which is a documentary about Agnes Varda. And sadly, she just passed away last year, so she's a bit of a legend. She was, how old was she? She was like 90.
She was in her 90s. In her 90s.
But maybe we should just start with, who is Agnes Varda and why is she so cool, Amanda?
She's so cool. She basically is like, she's often referred to as like the lone woman of the French New Wave kind of cinematic movement. But she also made films in that style before Godard or Truffaut or any of the guys who were kind of more heralded for that movement did. She made La Pointe Court, which was her first feature in 1954, and that was kind of the start of the French New Wave, and that was like really revolutionary at the time. It kind of combined documentary footage with this narrative, and people really hadn't seen anything like that. And so she was like really a trailblazer. And then she kind of had a career that spanned like 50 years, so she's done so much in that time. And so from that she kind of made Cleo, which was her probably her most famous feature, Cleo from 5 to 7, and that is the one I was introduced to her with. I studied that in Film 101 at University of Auckland. Thanks, thanks, Jenny. That was my favourite film of that whole syllabus, and it was just like something so different to all the other narrative films that I'd seen, and I felt really connected to that kind of way of making work.
So her style of filmmaking is very singular in the sense that, I mean, there's a lot of people who've kind of copied her style now, but when she started making movies, as you were saying, she was the first person to do it, and she kind of sparked this whole new kind of filmmaking out of France. She's always lauded as this great feminist icon as well. She was making movies kind of about women and from a woman's perspective as well. What is it about her like specific style of movie making that makes her different from other people?
I think she's really just curious about people, and she's really like sensitive in her filmmaking, and you can tell that she really cares about her subject. She makes a lot of documentaries and fiction films, which I think a lot of filmmakers kind of prioritize one of those over the other, but she has gone back and forth throughout her whole career between the two, and I think that really shows even in her fiction filmmaking. She sometimes uses documentary methods, and it just comes across very realistic and like really humanistic, and she really cares about people. And I think another thing is just the how early in her career she did prioritize kind of women's stories or tell stories of kind of revolutionary feminist topics. Like, she also, after she had made a few features herself, she went off and did a couple of documentaries about different leftist topics. Like, she made made the documentary about the Black Panthers. And, yeah, she's just done so much, and kind of all of that experience comes through.
She has a real eye for, like, a human story, I guess, for want of a better way of saying it. She's really good at finding, I guess, a perspective or a take on a story that shows you the real people at the heart of it, but does it in such a beautiful and quite stylistic way as well. There's an amazing sort of, like, if you look up people who have sort of, like, been inspired by Agnes Varda, and you started watching those Agnes Varda movies, you can really start to see how much influence she's had across the board in filmmaking, because it's such a dense way she makes films.
So what did you find Varda by Agnes about? Like, was that about her career?
Yeah, that was kind of the last film that she kind of helped make, that was made about her, before she passed away this past March. And so in 2017, and it played in last year's film festival, was Faces Places, another documentary kind of about her rather than
by her.
On another topic,
And so that was about her and this younger artist called JR. And it was only really then that she kind of found this internet kind of fame, or, like, found fame. I think, obviously, there's been people who have loved her work, like, throughout time, and that have been really influenced by her. But I think she didn't really get her dues until really, really late in her life.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that happens with a lot of female filmmakers, is that they often die before, like, especially throughout kind of the 20th century, they often died before anyone
people
picked up and recognized the value of their work. But yeah, Varda by Agnes was cool. It was really beautiful. It's kind of is structured around this talk that she's giving to young filmmakers, and she's such a mischievous person, and just the way she talks is, and just watching her talk, and she's like this little lady, and she's just so fun
to watch. She's got an incredibly iconic haircut as well. If you Google a photo of Agnes Varda, she's quite amazing sort of, like, bowl cut hair that's, like, two-tone. It's completely white on the top, and then she's got, like, a red band around the bottom. It kind of looks like a hat.
It's so great.
One of those things, watching someone who's really, really, like, kind of, I guess, entertaining is the word, talk about something they're passionate about, is just one of those things that you can watch for hours and you'll never feel like bored or uninterested.
And it's kind of intercut with clips from her films throughout history, and so it's just so, it was really lovely.
Would you reckon that this would be a film that, if you didn't know anything about her or you hadn't seen any of her other films, this would still be a good film to go and see?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of a good intro, really, because she is basically introducing her whole kind of career. And so, yeah, it's definitely a good one to see. Another one that in the program that is kind of a cool intro to her, I would say, would be Vagabond.
I think that was the first movie I ever watched of hers.
It's just, it kind of summarizes everything that she's interested in, kind of this lone female drifter, and she's, like, just going around and making trouble. It's just fun, and it's obvious, it's sad, but it's really beautiful as well. And it just
and is that a fiction one, or is that
a fiction one? So there's the character Mona at the centre of that is played by, I think I'm going to say this wrong, but Sandrine Bonnet, a French actress, and it's not autobiographical, but it is still really lovely.
You can definitely see she's drawing on a few, maybe, things close to her own heart there.
Definitely.
So the films you can go and see by Agnes Varda, so there is Varda by Agnes, which is this big one that is about her. Mm-hmm. Kind of, she had a lot of input into it.
And that's a new release this year, isn't it?
The only one out in this program that's the newest one.
So that's new, so that's maybe a good entry point. But the other movies of hers that you can go and see, which come from across her whole career, is Daguerreotypes. There's also Jacques de Nantes, Le Bonheur, and Vagabond as well. So that's all of the films that you can go and see. If you want, you can have a real Agnes Varda love fest during the film fest this
I'll
year.
I'll see you there.
you've picked us a song to end this on. What have you picked for us, Amanda?
So this song is from, not one that's playing in the film festival this year, sadly, but it's from probably her most famous film, Cleo from 5 to 7, and it's just a song that Cleo sings exactly at the halfway point of the film.
This is called Sans Toi. Thank you so much, Amanda Jane, for bringing us up Varda by Agnes and all of the other amazing Agnes Varda films in the NZIFF. That was Sans Toi. That is from the film Cleo 5-7, which is a classic Agnes Varda movie. And there are so many ways you can get your eyes and ears around Agnes Varda in the NZIFF this year. There's the big doco on her called Varda by Agnes. That's a new one. There's also Daguerreotypes, Jaco de Nantes, Le Bonheur and Vagabond. They're all part of the Viva La Varda, showcase celebration of Agnes Varda at the film festival. And you can find all the details about tickets and times and places on the NZIFF website.
You've been listening to B-Movies, thanks to Metso Bar.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.